Are you struggling to find the right professional talent for your project? Are you working with a limited budget?
We are so excited about our next sponsor, Casting Networks. I have personally used Casting Networks to release a number of projects for free to the industry's largest network of professional performers for my commercial work and for my very first short film, Strange Thing.
Creators can manage submissions, schedule auditions, request and review self-tapes, and book top talent for their projects, all in one place. All for free.
On Casting Networks, you can create an account and send your casting call to thousands of professional talent. So join Casting Networks, the industry's preferred casting platform where more than 1.2 million performers have scheduled over 14 million auditions. That's a lot of auditions. Visit www.castingnetworks.com/movies to create an account for free today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast and my sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, will be coming out tomorrow. Whoa! 9/13. So if you're listening to this when the podcast airs, 7 a.m. on 9/12, it'll be tomorrow that you can watch the movie. So you still have time to pre-order it and help our numbers. So go to Apple TV and search The Alternate, or you can go to www.alternatebissell.com and you can buy it on DVD. I think I'll have the link by then up, and then of course you can just also watch it on Apple TV, or you can just search any place that rents or sells movies digitally and you can buy it or rent it there. And that's USA and Canada only, but we will be worldwide soon. So thank you very much for all your support, and I hope you guys love the movie.
Yay! I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Speed of Life and Bread and Butter. I'm currently in development on 52 more. I'm a distribution consultant who used to manage Sundance's creative distribution initiative.
This week, we welcome writer director Jeff Baigna on the show, the filmmaker behind movies like Life After Beth, Joshy, The Little Hours, and Horse Girl, to talk about his latest film, Spin Me Around, starring Alison Brie, among many other talented actors. Jeff also talks about interning for Robert Zemeckis, which I didn't even know about. I'm really glad Liz asked that question because that was amazing. And then how he went from that situation to writing I Heart Huckabee with David O. Russell, of all people, which was sounded like an insane situation, which he couldn't really go into all the details on. And then he talked a lot about how shooting Spin Me Around was the toughest shoot yet for him. But then after that, we play yet another round of the game, which is really exciting. But first, Liz, how are you doing today?
Doing okay. It was a record heat wave in Los Angeles this past weekend. It was very, very, very hot. And so we stayed inside. And, you know, that can get to you after a while. So it was like 3 days with the toddler inside with the curtains drawn just to really make you feel trapped. Just to really make you feel like you can't go anywhere. Just darkness shrouding you thematically, sentimentally, psychologically. Other than that, we got rejected from some horror film festivals, but we got into another big one, but I'm not allowed to say what it is, but it's in the UK. So that's exciting.
Ooh, I have some guesses. I won't say, but I think I know what it could be.
Do you?
I think so. If it's a big one in the UK horror film festival, I think I know what it is.
It's not, I'll just tell you offline. It is a big one, but it's not Fright Fest, and it's not.
Oh,
because Fright Fest has just already happened. Like, it's not. Oh. So I had a feeling you thought it was Fright Fest, and so I was like, I didn't want you. But it's not. It's the equally great A-list of my heart film festival.
Nice. Oh, there we go.
But I just have been feeling like really supported by the genre world. It's just crazy how like I make these indie dramedies and like no one gives a shit. And then I make this like small 10-minute horror film and I feel like, oh, I finally feel like a world has embraced me. And so I'm enjoying that. I'm enjoying the genre space. Yeah.
Has any screening happened yet for the movie? Or
yeah. And we have a Letterboxd page, which I did not create.
Ooh.
So it screened at Popcorn Frights and it's going to screen at Scream Fest soon. It's going to screen at Tallgrass soon.
Wow.
It's screening at this place called Foggy Isle in Canada. And they have a Twitch screening of it. So I get to go on Twitch.
Oh, fun.
And then this other one is coming in November. I'll say that.
Wow. Nice. That's so exciting.
Yeah.
What has the response been like? Have you heard from anyone who's seen the movie? Any nice words? Any reviews? Anything you could speak of?
Well, Letterboxd, they've said nice things. But I might have mentioned him before, but I hired this lovely man named Ted, who's a horror filmmaker himself. But I hired him as our like festival consultant lobbyist guy.
Nice.
And he is going to try to make a moment out of this UK festival screening as well as Screamfest. Cool. So we're going to go out. I have one review from Film Snobbery in the books, but other than that, like, I'm enjoying, I just like genre. I just think that people are not snobs over here, even in spite of that guy's name. And then Amy and I are sending out our latest draft of Best Friends Forever, and it feels real. It feels like we're going to make that movie. So that's exciting. I think everyone should just come over to the genre pool. I mean, think of how happy and exciting times you are in right now with your genre film.
I love genre. It's the best. It's pretty much like I kind of made a decision a long time ago that I was just going to be a genre filmmaker, that was like what I was going to make and what I was interested in making and all I really wanted to make. And so that's all I've kind of made. I made like one drama short, you know, I made a documentary short, you know, but like I pretty much just live in the genre space and I love it. And I don't think I really want to go elsewhere just because it's a lot of fun. The fans are fun.
Yes.
People respond to things. They write comments about things. You know, they're excited to see it, you know. You could sometimes polarize fans, which is also fun. Like people will either really like something or really hate it. And I think that's so much better than like no one caring or like being like, you did good job.
Yeah.
That's really good. And I think that when you make a drama or like, you know, whatever, like more of a straight movie, that's sort of like what you get. It's like your mom telling
like you accomplished something. It looks like a real movie. You know, look at that real movie you made.
I know. It's the worst. That's sort of, I feel like when that's what you get from the drama world. But like when you're in genre, it's like people like want to talk about it. They have emotional reactions to the things. It's like you can strike chords with people. It's just so much more fun. So I'm really glad that you're enjoying being in the genre space.
You know? Yeah. Tell me how you are.
I'm doing well. It's been kind of a roller coaster with the movie. Huh. We had this really funny thing happen where the date was wrong. Like the release date kind of got confused between our distributor and, you know, our PR team.
Well, it changed. I remember you. I thought it was...
It was 9/13 forever. And then they were like 9/6. And we're
That's
like, okay,
right.
9/6.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like last week at some point, I guess it was when I got the pre-order link. It said 9/13. And I was like, hey, we've been telling everybody 9/6. Like,
That's right.
Is it still 9/13? And they were like, yeah, we don't know why you're saying 9/6. And it's like, well, that's what all the press releases went out as 9/6. Like all the, you know, everything was 9/6. And then like, of course, they've been making effort now to update it and tell everyone 9/13. So that's been fine. But yeah, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal. It's just a little bit silly. You know, we're hoping that we're going to land some more interviews with the extra week. So our PR team is working on that. And, you know, I've just been going on Rotten Tomatoes and like looking at the approved critics. And so now like this last week, I think what I'm going to do is just like email like any like, you know, tomato meter critic and just be like, hey, did you see our press release? Movie's coming out. Here's our trailer. We've got 160,000 views on this one link or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's actually 170,000 now.
Woohoo!
Across all YouTube links, which is very exciting. But yeah, so I'm trying to get some more reviews in. We got a new review from Real Reviews, which was really cool.
Yay.
I don't know if you know who Real Reviews is. I was not familiar. But then a filmmaker friend of the show, Casey DeFramery, reached out and he was like, how did you get them to review your movie? Like, they only do, like, you know, studio films and like, big things. I was like, oh, I didn't know that. That's cool. That's awesome. And so, yeah, I was like, oh, it's my PR team did it. Like, I had nothing to do with it. But we got a really good review from them, which was really nice. And yeah, so now I'm just, like, waiting for more reviews to come in. I did, what was it? I think 6 interviews so far for the movie.
Those are fun, though. Like, you must have fun.
Oh, yeah, it was great. And then I did one with our friends over at Just Shoot It. Everybody should be listening to Just Shoot It as well as us, because they are great. So thanks to Matt and Oren for doing that. I think that's actually going to come out this week, which is very cool.
Makes sense.
And I'm going to be on Alex Ferrari's show too on Indie Film Hustle, but he's like so busy. He's like, I can't get you in. I'll get you in when I can, but I can't get you in now. I got Toronto coming up. I got all these things coming up. It's so busy. So much happening, you know. So he's very sweetly sneaking me in probably sometime in early October, which is like, I don't care. Like, better late than never. Like, you know, the more press, the more words about the movie is great. And I'm really grateful that he's willing to do that. And, you know, we're like, it's so fun. He's like talking on the phone and like just catching up with him. And, you know, he's like looking at his calendar, trying to pencil me in. It was really fun. So yeah, it's been cool. It's been cool to like, you know, shout out from the mountaintops about the movie. I sent the pre-order link to like, you know, social media. Like I emailed some people. I emailed all the people that, you know,
Seed and Spark backers.
Yeah, exactly. All them.
I got
all
that
the
one.
Investors, all the people, you know, who worked on the movie is like a 90-person chain of the you know, not just including the, it's like the cast, it's the crew, it's all the people who helped us, all the vendors, it's all the locations people. It's like we kind of have a huge list of people who wanted to be, you know, in getting updates. So like, yeah, I sent it out to a bunch of people. I haven't really done individual emails yet. Maybe I'll start doing that this week. There's just so much to do, you know. It's like, yeah, it's really hard to do all the press that you could possibly cover. But I was pretty happy. Like I did those 6 interviews, some with my producer. He did one on his own that he got booked. I have another one coming up this week, and then I'm hoping we get another couple more. So like, you know, and then Jeff was saying that, like, you know, whatever, it's like almost 10, or it's gonna be around 10 or so when all said and done. He was like, that's more interviews than I've done for most of the films that I've released. So I was like, okay,
that's interesting.
I felt pretty good about that. I don't know if, like, when you did your press, how many do you tend to do, like when you did Bread and Butter? And
well, I say yes to everything.
Yeah, me too.
But like, no, but like, even if they're like a podcast with like 5 listeners, I'm like, yes, please, can I? So I you know, probably around 10, maybe a little bit more, but like,
yeah,
I had a publicist.
So try harder, is what you're hearing me say. Okay, no, I'll try harder, Liz.
No, I think you're doing great. I think you're doing great. I just didn't know 10 was like a meaningful number. I didn't really think to quantify it ever. So I just remember just doing a lot of them. That's all.
Yeah, I think as many as you can do, right, the better. And I agree with you, like big or small, it doesn't matter. Like if they have 5 followers, or they have 105 followers, or 10,000 followers, or whatever, like it's all really good business. And it's just more you can talk about, more you can share out to your community.
Like, I think as artists, we need to learn how to sell ourselves, how to sell our film, and how to talk about it. And if you don't have an, I mean, like, fuck up as much as you can right now, because you need to get better at this. Not you specifically, but any filmmaker needs to get better at talking about themselves and their films.
Yeah, totally. The other thing that we could always get better at is talking about our Patreon page. You can go over to www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast. You'll find our weekly meetings with Liz, Eric, and I talking about the behind the scenes of making of the show, which is always fun. We've got some bonus episodes that are going to be coming out. I swear, I have one on my desktop that I have to post. I think it's like so little amount of work for me to do to get it ready to share with everybody, but it's just like I've got so much stuff going on. I haven't been able to do it yet. But yeah, you know, also Liz makes, you know, individual little videos. I've made little individual videos. So there's little bonus things on there for people to check out. But it's the way that the show keeps on going. So if you love the show, you love what you're hearing every week from us, please support us on Patreon. It means a lot to us. You should also check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They're great partners to us. They're basically an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers. And they have a bunch of different programs they offer, including consultation courses, contests, and their top 25 writers list featuring some of their best writers. So you should go over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. But without any more delays, here's our chat with Jeff Bania.
We'll start off by asking you, can you give us the elevator pitch for Spin Me Round?
A manager from an Italian franchise restaurant in America gets the opportunity to go to Italy to learn about food, wine, and culture at that restaurant's institute, and things devolve into unsavory chaos.
How many days did you shoot the film?
22.
What can you speak of with regard to the budget?
I can, like, what is the budget?
Yeah, but I have to be, like, sneaky about it.
I guess I have to be sneaky about it. I mean, I could say one thing that was interesting is we were able to get a tax credit from Italy. I think it was like 40% of our budget was,
wow,
basically we got a rebate on. So that was like that was incredible. But I could also say, like any filmmaker, that the budget, you know, wasn't enough, and there wasn't enough days and enough hours in the day.
Could you give a range, even if it's like under 20 million, just any sort of relative sense of the resources you had to work with?
It was definitely under 20 million. So it's like smaller than a bread box. Yeah, I would say it was a little bit more than I had on Horse Girl, but not like a crazy amount more. And that's all I'm at liberty to say.
Okay. Yeah.
And then how'd you come up with the idea for the movie?
I had just shot The Little Hours and came back to America, and I saw this article that some manager from an unnamed Italian franchise restaurant had an opportunity to go to their institute in Italy and had all these like expectations, and on the website or the brochure, I can't remember which one it was, there was a picture of this villa that was like this iconic villa for this particular restaurant. And so they had all these expectations, got there. It turns out that was just, you know, like for staging. And then they were staying in this like disgusting dorm, and there really wasn't a structure to the program. And the chef de cuisine of this unnamed franchise restaurant just made a bolognese demonstration. And then that was pretty much it. So they kind of felt trapped. And I just thought that was a pretty funny setup for a movie to obviously use that as a launching off point.
When was that? And the question really is, how long did you spend working on the film from seeing that article until now?
So I saw that article in the spring of 2016. And I wrote like a 14 or 15 page outline based on that article and sort of the broad strokes of what ended up being the outline for this movie. For various reasons, kind of put it in the back burner, and then did Horse Girl. And then having had collaborated with Allison, brought her this idea and showed her the outline I had written. And then we worked on another outline to, well, we sort of, you know, added more to the outline and got it to like, I don't know, 28 pages or something, 25 pages. And we were supposed to make this the summer of 2020, but obviously COVID hit, and COVID hit Italy really hard. And so we had to put it in the back burner again. But in the interim, we decided to write it as an actual screenplay, which my first movie I did was based on a real screenplay, but my last three movies were just based on outlines. And we thought that would help us get a little bit more undisclosed amount of money so that we could do it more justice, and then shot it using the script as opposed to an outline.
Compared to all the other projects you've made, how difficult was it to make this one?
This was probably the most difficult one I've ever done. I mean, my first movie that got produced was I Heart Huckabees, and I was just a writer on it. So speaking as a director, this was the hardest one. That was obviously extremely difficult. This one, we had a series of challenges, including COVID, which you guys are familiar with. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff that kind of went down. One thing in particular is we didn't have a producer on set, which was a unique experience. I don't know how many movies can say that happened. There was time constraints. Like initially we had a 27-day schedule with 12-hour days. And then pretty much when we got there, we found out that it's like in Italy, you can only shoot 8-hour days. Mm. And then our initial budget that was drafted was pretty unrealistic by a significant margin. So we had to chop 5 days off the schedule. And so we lost 5 days in the schedule and lost 4 hours every day that was part of that 27-day schedule into 22 days. So it was pretty intense.
Both Arik and I perked up when you said you didn't have a producer on set. Can you go into that a little bit more?
I mean, I can't, I'm, you know, without like throwing people under the bus, I can't really go into it more, but.
So it wasn't intentional. It wasn't purposeful. And on behalf of Italy, they weren't like, we don't believe in producers anymore. You know,
no, it was like, not by design. I would not recommend that dynamic. I would say it was unfortunate. And, you know, it definitely had rippling effects, but, you know, life gives you lemons. You just have lemons. So,
well, just to push this a little bit further, like, what was the process that you came up with to solve for not having a producer? Like, is there something that you and your team did in order to like kind of share the burden of the role without having one with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it was ultimately by committee, I would say. I did my best to fill in the role. I mean, I got a producer credit, and I think there were expectations for me to produce. I think as a director, there are some limitations to how much you can produce while you're directing. But I, you know, Allison and I both had to step it up a lot. And, you know, various departments kind of had to fill in the power vacuum. So it was sort of an organic response. I mean, there really is nothing you can do. So it was a unique situation. It was definitely a learning experience for a lot of people. And I would not recommend it.
Yeah. I read up a little bit about your bio, your history, and I saw that you worked with Zemeckis at the top of your career. And I was just curious, our household is a big Zemeckis fan.
Yeah. Fandom.
Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, what was that working relationship like? And the sub question is, like, can you compare it to the David O. Russell relationship that you moved into after that?
Okay. So I went to NYU film school. I'm from Miami. And when I graduated film school, I moved out to Los Angeles and I wasn't really sure how to get a job. And two things that I did that were super bizarre that ended up being fortuitous is, number one, a friend of mine who had graduated a year earlier got a job working for Miramax while Weinstein was still there as a script reader. And I asked to see what his resume looked like because I didn't know what you're supposed to put on a resume to get a film job. Like, are you supposed to list your short films you shot in films? I wasn't clear on what you're supposed to do. And he sent me his resume, and for whatever reason, he, like, it said his name and his contact information, and it said backgrounds, and that he was born in Norman, Oklahoma. So I was like, oh, you just have to put where you're from. So I put that I was born in Miami, Florida on my resume, which makes no sense. And then I also didn't know how you get a job. So there's this, the Hollywood Reporter used to, I think it was on Thursdays, maybe, every week they would put out a list of all the movies in pre-production, production, and post-production, just like a comprehensive list with, like, you know, phone numbers and fax numbers of the production offices. And so I just did a cover letter and resume to every single thing that was in all stages of production. And for whatever reason, this guy, Jack Rocky, who used to be Zemeckis's agent and then became his producing partner with Steve Starkey and created this company called Image Movers that had a deal with DreamWorks, just happened to walk by the fax machine or the inbox desk and saw my resume on top and noticed that I went to NYU and was from Miami, and he went to NYU and was from Miami. So he had me come in to take a meeting, and Zemeckis, they all call him Bob, but I didn't do that because it's like, you know, when people call Martin Scorsese Marty, it's just, I don't know him. But anyway, Zemeckis, he was basically shooting What Lies Beneath and Castaway. And so he had just shot the first half of Castaway. And in the interim, while Tom Hanks was losing 40 plus pounds to look emaciated while he's on a desert island, he immediately shot the entire What Lies Beneath with, I think, maybe a week or two in between with that little bit of a buffer. Then, so I came on as they just were starting What Lies Beneath. And then I was with them until they finished Castaway. Zemeckis was incredible. My first day on the job, I think I might've been a Friday, or it was either a Thursday or a Friday. I just remember, you can look up on the calendar, which I can't do right now because I'm on the Zoom, but I remember it was September 9th, 1999. It was like 9/9/99. And I remember Jack Rocky was like, do you realize the date? What's with you, kid? This is crazy. He thought we had this like cosmic connection because he also DP'd a lot of people's movies in school, which is what I did. I just shot a lot of people's movies because I just remembered how you load a camera. I think that was like the main reason. But so one of my first days was insane because Zemeckis was really sweet and would allow me to be on set and, like, you know, watch some stuff. But I was a PA. I wasn't even his assistant. I was just, you know, getting his laundry and dropping it off in Santa Barbara and stuff. But he's like, hey, Jeff, Steven's coming. Can you meet him at the gate? He's in a turquoise Explorer. Just bring him to set. So, like, there's Jack Rocky, who's the guy I talked about, who's the producing partner slash ex-agent of Zemeckis. And then Steve Starkey was his producer from, I don't know if he did Used Cars, but he definitely was around for Back to the Future and all that stuff. And so I was expecting to be Steve Starkey. And so I was waiting by the gate, and this, you know, teal, turquoise, whatever Explorer pulled up, and it was Steven Spielberg. So Steven Spielberg came out, and I had to escort Steven Spielberg to set. And he was like really sweet and kind. And he's like, oh, Bob's great. You know, Bob's great. You know, what an opportunity. And he was just really kind and stuff. And then because it was like a Friday, or I think it was a Thursday or Friday when this day happened, you know how it's like when you work for a corporation, like every 2 weeks or something, they give you a check but I only worked like one day. So I got a check for the one day I'd worked. And I didn't have direct deposit at that time because I was 22. And so I went to the Washington Mutual branch, and because this was all owned by Sony, which is in Culver City, I went to the Washington Mutual there. And I remember I was like depositing the check at the teller. And the guy next to me came up and was like, I would like $250,000, please. And I was like, I just clocked that because I thought that was super strange. And then the teller was like, okay, well, you know, who's your account? Like, what's your name, sir? He's like, I want $250,000 and I have a bomb. And then I looked towards the back entrance and there was a guy kind of blocking it. So I ran out the side entrance and got out of there and then drove home as fast as I could. And then on the news, I had this high speed chase of this bank robbery. So that was like my first day. And then, so I worked with Bob for, I don't know, it was like a year. And then because of the intensity of his schedule, where he basically shot the equivalent of three movies, but two movies back to back, you know, or within back to back to back, I guess, he just wanted to like go to Jamaica for 4 years and just relax. And I was on this like trajectory to be, I guess, like an executive, but I wanted to be a filmmaker. And so I remember I sat down with Jack Rocky and I was telling him why I thought it would be a good idea for me to leave, because I want to do filmmaking and I feel like this wasn't going to give me the opportunity. It was really like the woman who's the office manager, who has since passed away, and she was amazing, Sharon Feller. She was kind of like my mom out here. We would just basically eat lunch. We'd have breakfast and then talk about what we would have for lunch. And then we would have lunch. And that was like our day because nothing was going on. And it was like, I was getting paid a good amount as a PA for 22. But I just was like, there's got to be more. And so I left a really cush job and got this job list and saw there was a director looking for an editor to help help on this documentary they were working on, and it happened to be David O. Russell. And so I got that job. And so for, I don't know, it was like 3 years, we wrote together. We did a bunch of scripts together. We wrote a Huckabees. We wrote a couple other scripts. We did a pass on Meet the Fockers. And it was an incredible learning experience because I was actually writing with him and I was a fan of his movies. And, you know, we got really close. I don't know how to handle this next part, but when shooting started, I would say things went off the rails and it got really ugly. And there was a lot of psychosexual impropriety, I would say, and a lot of Me Too crazy shit. So I got into a fight basically and got out of there because it was super insane. I'm trying to like protect the facts or whatever, but for the most part, it was god awful. And so I got out of there. And then so to compare those two experiences, I would say they were night and day. I'd say the writing experience with David was incredible. Production was not. And production with Bob Zemeckis, who I'm now calling Bob, was incredible. Like, he was a super generous person. I mean, as a kid, Back to the Future was obviously such an important movie. And I loved True Friend Roger Rabbit. And I loved Used Cars, which I saw when I was too young. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that movie, but it's awesome.
Yeah.
And so, you know, having access to that size of Hollywood production was incredible. I don't know if I'll ever get to that stage, but it was really fun being involved with him.
I don't really want to make this a big part of the interview, but I'm just curious, like, because you talked about you applied for this editor job with David O. Russell, mm-hmm. and then that led to like writing multiple scripts. Like, that seems like a pretty big jump to like go from, you know, getting this job. And did you have editor experience? Like, how did you go from being a PA to an editor and then go from an editor to like collaborating with this filmmaker? Like, that seems like...
Yeah, I guess to clarify, I was as an assistant editor. This woman, Deb Light, was the editor. Okay. So I would just come in at night and, you know, tweak stuff and then do a lot of like the busy work for editing and logging and capturing and stuff. And then, you know, it's like when you're editing stuff, sometimes you're making recommendations, you know, it's like, oh, it would be nice. Cause he was still shooting it as we were doing that. And nothing ended up happening because it was right before the .com bust. And it was for this website that I think went under like almost immediately, but it was like a fake, you know, almost like a mockumentary about this guy, Ben Bray, who was a stuntman on, I think, Three Kings. He was my stunt coordinator for Life After Beth, but he's awesome. And yeah, I mean, it really was like, you know, assistant editor, assistant, lines were being blurred. And then there was this sort of event that happened where I got into a car accident that literally don't want to bore you guys with a long story, but it was like, I had a premonition, I had a dream of this whole thing, and it was super crazy. But like, to make a long story short, my eye got messed up. And as the day went on, my eye got worse and worse and worse. So David's wife brought me to the eye doctor and I had an ulcerated cornea. And it's the kind of thing where like the cornea has a hole in it and bacteria starts just eating away at that hole until it gets bigger and you could lose your sight. So luckily she brought me there and saved my sight. So while I was waiting for my girlfriend at the time to come pick me up to take me home, because I couldn't drive because I couldn't see. Because I don't know if you know this, but like, you know, your pupils are in sync. So even if you have one eye closed and one eye open, both eyes will react to light, even in the closed eye. So every time my pupil was dilating, it was killing me because you'd feel it on your cornea. So it was a disaster. So he was just trying to like keep me company, David, while I was like on the floor in agony and was kind of telling me these ideas he had for movies. And was just sort of spitballing them. And then while I was recovering, because I had another nightmare, this is almost like a setup for a horror movie, but like every hour on the hour, I had to put these drops in my eye to stop the bacteria from eating my cornea. So you never really got sleep because it's like literally every hour you have to wake up. But he felt that. So he sent me a bunch of movies. Like, I remember one was The Heartbreak Kid, which I hadn't seen at that point, and I thought was amazing. The original, not the remake. And yeah, so I think he recognized that we were somewhat on the same wavelength and we're kind of kindred spirits. And I think he liked what I was saying about his ideas and where I thought they could go. And to make another long story short, there was this like story, this script with a New Line called Dr. Zinkin's Go For It Goes For It, which was an adaptation. Am I talking too much, by the way? I can't tell. An adaptation of Henry's List of Wrongs, which was this book that was like this real melodrama about a guy who's like a successful banker, but goes back to his hometown to get revenge on the girl who dumped him on prom to be like, check me out. But turns out she died that year when he was going to prom and she just dumped him because she knew he wouldn't be anything if he stayed home. And he like makes a list of all the people he wronged and then tries to make it right. And it was like really sappy. And so we kind of reinvented this idea from scratch about this like dickhead dermatologist who like falls in love with his yoga teacher and then basically joins a version of the Landmark Forum. And like part of it is like to go and apologize to people you've done, but he like makes it so much worse by doing that, because he's doing it just to be with this girl. And he initially had wanted me to just like write it for him and then, you know, sort of ghostwrite the scripts. And then I just kind of appealed to his frugality and said, hey, why don't you have New Line pay for it? Like, why do you want to spend, you know, you don't have to lose any money. You don't have to pay me, just have them pay. So that's how I became a writer, was by kind of doing a Jedi mind trick. And then we wrote a bunch of scripts together and then production happened.
Wow.
This is amazing. No, you're not talking too much, please.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm sensing there's something about relationships to explore here. I mean, the way you kind of, what you connected, you had these fast connections with really impressive people and then, you know, continue to earn your way through the industry after meeting them. I'm noticing also the repeat relationships with certain actors and the work you do. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about improvisation and that developing of trust with talent. Mm-hmm. Could you, and it's an open-ended question, but do you have things to say about that?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely is all about relationships. I think it's relationships and sort of understanding opportunities. And I think taking advantage of opportunities. I mean, I think if I hadn't jumped at that chance to pitch him not wasting his own money on me writing a script, I probably wouldn't have been a professional screenwriter, which then would have prevented me from ultimately becoming a director. So I think that was like a real inflection point for me in terms of the people I work with. Trust is super important. And also, you know, understanding. And, you know, it's like if you meet somebody, let's say if you're like doing a job interview for like a key position on the crew, it's like the same thing as like a cold read for an actor doing a script. It's like some people are just really good at that stuff. Some people are really good at doing interviews. Some people are really good at just like nailing an audition, but that might be the best you're going to get. Or like, you know, there might be a dark side that you didn't see. So the more you work and the more opportunities you have to work with people, you can kind of parse who's a keeper and, you know, who's not a keeper. Similarly with crew, I feel that way for the most part about actors. It's just, I happen to be lucky and work with all these actors that I love. And so one of the consequences of that is I just keep making bigger and bigger ensemble movies because I just keep looking for ways to incorporate all these people that I love working with over and over again. And especially since I do generally work in a more improvisational style. This last movie there was not a lot of improvisation because we didn't really have time. But, you know, this was a script. My first one's a script. It's hard to say like how other directors work. I mean, I've been on other sets and I'm always like, oh, that's how you work. But every, you know, it's such a unique, singular job. And, you know, it's no writer writes the same way. You know, it's like clearly if you work in any job, I think there's like an opportunity for variety. But I think especially with creative stuff, it really is dependent on the personality of the creator. Improvisation is all about trust and vulnerability and, you know, being able to be in the moment and being able to respond to things authentically. And so when I find people that I feel like can inhabit that, as well as sort of vacillate between comedy and drama successfully without it feeling like, you know, there's a hitch, I'm drawn to those people and want to keep working with them. And also I do love actors. So generally develop a rapport with these people and want to keep working with them and, you know, love shooting with them. And, you know, production is my favorite. I love being on set and I love working with actors. So I don't know. There's just having that in your back pocket that like I've worked with this person before. They know how I work and they're down, I think is invaluable.
Can you talk about how your process changes when you work with an outline versus a script? Is there a certain way that you approach a project on set for both styles, or is it the same, but you just have to make other adjustments?
It's definitely different. When you work with a script, the sort of downside is that it's harder to really successfully improvise because everyone is sort of prepared for what's happening. And I think the joy of improvisation is that all the actors are really present because they don't know exactly what's going to happen. So their responses are actual responses as opposed to like premeditated responses. It's hard to do hybrid versions of it. Like I know Robert Altman would have, I know for MASH, like he had the script and he said, forget the script, let's start from scratch. I think that's great if you can do that, but then you have to do it, you have to commit. Like I think kind of doing like hybrid versions are hard because like I said, you're always going to go back to the safety of knowing that you have this line to fall back on. And there's something kind of inauthentic about, like there's a, do you know, like the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, they have this one night they do called Gravid Water. You guys know about that? Mm-mm. So what they would do is they would have one, there's always, it's like, it's usually two people. One person has like a one act play or one act scene or whatever it is that they memorize all their lines for. And the other person has no idea what it's going to be. So regardless of what this person's saying, they're just going to say their lines. And so it's really funny, but it's like, it sort of highlights the absurdity of that. And to some extent, that is somewhat of the danger you can get into where there is this like live wire, like fast and loose vibe with, you know, improvising. And then there's like this sort of more staid, you know, version of like, well, now is my time to say this. And sometimes that incongruity can be highlighted. So it's probably best that, you know, like for this movie, that there were some improvisational moments. So, you know, when we did a table read, there's one line that Zach said in the table read, Zach Woods, that I thought was hysterical, where Alessandra Nivola says, like, do you know what it's like to hold your sister's hand as she's dying? And then Zach said, no, how could I? That'd be an insane coincidence, or something like that. I thought that was really funny, so I just put it in the script. But like, there's like one scene where Molly confronts Allison in a hallway, and I just kind of let Molly do her thing. I mean, of course, like, I was directing her, but like, I just let her kind of be really loose with it, because I thought it was, I love her so much, and I thought she could just kind of run with it, and it sort of lent itself to that. And obviously Allison is really capable. I think when you have a large group of people, it's harder to kind of pull it off. And a lot of these scenes, sometimes we had like 11 people in the scene. So due to like what I mentioned, we lost a bunch of days and we lost a bunch of hours per day. There wasn't, you know, we had to get closer. Like, I'm not word perfect person. Like, you just get the gist of what the script says is good enough for me, but we really couldn't go off reservation too much.
You've achieved such a degree of success. I'm curious if financing is almost automatic for you at this point, or if it feels like with every film that you're starting from scratch.
I mean, it depends. I think I've been lucky in that financiers have generally, I mean, I think always made their money back. So it's good for me moving forward, knowing that investors will feel safe that they can at least make their money back on the sale at whatever festival it's at. I'm personally of the opinion that the longer like a project is sort of sitting around and you're trying to force it, sometimes you kind of miss the boat, and it's not a good idea to like force it too much. That like the energy, if it's fresh and new, you can kind of force it and make it happen like in the moment. But I don't know. It's like I've developed relationships with investors. I have relationships with obviously actors and producers and production companies and distributors. And so I think to some extent, it's not like a nightmare trying to get stuff financed, but you know, making like your title of your podcast, making movies is hard. And there's, you know, to be super honest, like when we did Horse Girl, that movie experience was not hard. It was the only time I've ever had a not hard experience. It was like a dream, and it was beautiful. And like the crew was amazing and the cast was amazing, and everything kind of went our way for the most part, to the point where I had so much confidence going into this new one that like, you know, I feel like I got this, like this is kind of easy. And then I kind of set myself up for like, you know, to be blindsided by, you know, unexpected things that you've never been through. But the more experiences you have, obviously you're more prepared. And I think also working in an improvisational style, I value having outside forces infiltrate and kind of cause some amount of chaos. I like that messy energy. And I think that probably helps me a little bit, because if everything's like a perfectly made watch that, you know, it's like clockwork or whatever, it's a really hard life. But I think if you're open to things kind of flipping and changing and losing a location the night before you're supposed to shoot and having to reconceive a scene, like that kind of stuff is actually fun for me, because I do like puzzles and challenges and games. And so that stuff doesn't stress me out as much as it probably should.
It's kind of a follow up on that same line of thought. Like, has your like process for getting a movie made changed across your five features? Like, are you doing the same thing you did on Life After Beth that you did for Spin Me Round, or is it different now that you've made more and more movies?
It's definitely different. I mean, I think every movie is different. It's its own animal. I don't know if you guys watch the Irma Vett TV show that just came out, the Olivia Sayas show.
I watched the old movie. I haven't watched the show yet, but
oh, the show's incredible. I mean, the movie's great, obviously, but I think the show's incredible, and really kind of the first episode has a lot of exposition. So it might be like a little bit of drudgery if you want something that's like hyper specific, but after that, it gets into the minutia of filmmaking and what it's like. And there is sort of like a theme or sort of a motif throughout the show about how there's almost like a spirit of a movie, like, and how it can inhabit you and inhabit, haunt you almost. And I think that's true for the most part. You know, I think the lead actor or actress tends to be inhabited by the character they're portraying. I think the director is sort of following this sort of, I don't want to say mystical because it sounds cheesy, but it is kind of like this weird, almost magical energy that is what the movie is. Like, it's like, is this the movie or is this the movie? You can kind of feel it intuitively. I think that show does an excellent job of distilling that. And I don't want to ruin it, but like the end of that show feels what it feels like to kind of like end a movie on an almost like poetic level. So I would say every movie is its own thing. And I think I particularly strive to not repeat myself. I try to kind of mix it up a lot and feel like the movies I'm making are things that I've kind of never seen before and want to get into. But in my mind, it's almost like an experiment every time. So I'm always trying new techniques and new styles just to keep it fresh.
I'm under the impression that you don't use social media very often. It was an informed impression by your publicity team. Uh-huh. I'm curious, are you at all concerned with creating a public profile? And does that infiltrate your thoughts, or is it something that you completely disregard and you focus on the work?
I focus on the work. I mean, I have like an Instagram, but it's private and it's just my friends. I've been told by multiple people that it would be smart if I, you know, opened it up to not being private, but I don't really see the difference. I have friends that are in the same sort of, I guess, tier as me as a director. And, you know, I see them with a check mark on their Instagram, and I don't think there's any difference. I just like don't need to have my private life out there. Like, it's not as important to me. And, you know, I probably wouldn't have as big of a following as most of the actors in my movies. So, and there's a lot of overlap since most of us are all friends. We have a lot of similar friends. So, you know, me posting about the opening dates of my movie to my friends is not like going to have as much impact as someone who has a bunch of fans that, you know, like millions of fans or whatever. So there's not like a much of a practical implication. And I'm truthfully not the biggest fan of social media in general. Like, I think it's clearly not having a positive influence on society. So I don't know. That's kind of a hot take, I guess.
Can you talk about how you work with actors, especially like, you know, A-list celebrity or legendary actors like Molly Shannon? Like, do you approach them different than you approach just an unknown actor, or is it all kind of the same?
It's all the same. I treat all actors with the same amount of respect. Like, ideally, you're not like walking on eggshells with a high profile actor and then, you know, like barely acknowledging, like, you know, someone who has just a couple lines. Like, for me, it's like, you never know. It's like they're all great. The reason why I put them in the movie is they fit into this movie. So they're all part of this thing. Like, whether they have more lines or less lines, they're all essential and they're all just as important and they're all human beings. There's, you know, like, I think there are a lot of sort of traditions about, you know, treating certain people better and people worse. I think I'm not as sort of elitist about it. I you know, people that have one or two lines in a movie are hanging out with us. You know, when we went to South by Southwest and we're showing the movie, two of the Italian actors who had smaller parts in the movie stayed in the house with us, all of us, like the big actors, because I love them. And like, I think if, you know, generally if I'm working with these people, there's a reason why they're in it. And the negative version of it is like, a chain is only strong as its weakest link. It's like, whatever the inverse of that also applies to acting. So, you know, a movie is only as good as, I don't want to be negative, but like, a movie is good because even the person who has like a couple of lines is good. They're not sticking out like a sore thumb. They're part of the whole thing. And that's hard to pull off. And they deserve to be celebrated just as much as anyone else.
Eric, I think we have to move to the final six questions. Do you have a last question for Jeff?
No, that does it for me. I mean, I could ask questions all day, but I don't want to like...
Yeah, I have like 45.
Only have so much time.
Jeff, what's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now?
Like film? Like on film?
Yeah, or any way you... It could be a classroom assignment. It could be a video for a book report, whatever. However you interpret it.
I think like the first hardcore... I mean, I made tons of movies when I was a kid on video. I mean, I remember for... Was it American History in 10th grade, maybe? I would do as much as I could to get extra credit. And I remember... I also was always drawn to like the weird things in history. And I remember reading it was like a one sentence thing in our history book about the Aroostook War. Have you heard of that? In the 1800s. Basically, like the line of demarcation between Canada and America and Maine was ambiguous, and it was off by like half a mile or something. And so all these lumberjacks would cross what other country thought was like their country. So like the Americans were going over to the Canada side, Canadians were over to the American side. So there was this like really weird secret war happening between lumberjacks and bars all the time. And I thought that was hysterical. And so I made a video cutting together movies from other movies to sort of like highlight, almost like in a Ken Burns style, about the Aroostook War, as if it's this like really important piece of history, but just, I thought it was ridiculous.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
This is funny. So when we were doing Life After Beth, Gary Marshall was in it. I think it might have been his last scene he ever did, because he had just gone out of the hospital when he shot a scene with us. And I remember he took me off to the side and said, "Hey, I want to just give you a piece of advice." I'm like, "Oh my God, yes, like Gary Marshall." We went on a little walk. He's like, "Francis Ford Coppola told me this in like the 70s. He's like, this is the most important piece of advice you'll ever get as a director." And I was like, "What is it?" He's like, "Wear comfortable shoes." He's like, "You're going to be standing around all day. And if you're wearing like, you know, shoes without support, you're going to have back problems and leg problems and neck problems." He's like, "The best thing you could do for yourself is to wear comfortable shoes." So that was like the most practical directing advice ever. I thought it was great.
What's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received or heard or were exposed to?
Worst filmmaking advice. do it in a oneer. I mean, it's probably the worst advice you could ever get. I think a lot of directors think you can just kind of pull shit out in one shot and not give yourself any sort of coverage to cut away to. And especially in comedies, because everything is so about pacing and tone. Like if you're stringing together a bunch of oneers, it could be horrific. And like I personally, the way I work, even when I'm doing improvised movies, is I don't pre-storyboard anything or pre-sketch out the ideas of the camera movements. I always block it out with the actors and then come up with the shots after. So it's generally like while the actors are getting their makeup put on and getting dressed and stuff, I'll then devise the camera movements. So generally it's easy enough to start off with, you know, like two shots, singles and different sizes, whatever. But then I always do a moving master, which like effectively is a oneer, but I give myself the option of having things to cut away with that would be complementary to that oneer, because you just, anytime the DP or whoever is like, no, we could just do it in a oneer, that and you can just fix it in post are two things that are just like nightmare things to hear from your DP, because it will never match. So just get it in the can the right way and give yourself options, because you never know what you're gonna have to do later.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I mean, ideally I'm making films for the rest of my life. Like I want to always be making movies. I think like as long as you're constantly churning it out, every time you have a movie that is like less successful than the ones before it, it's nice to have something else to kind of work towards instead of lingering in your mind on this nightmare situation. So I think the idea of having a chain of films that just continues on down the horizon is an ideal scenario for me, because I love making movies so much.
If you could go back in time, mm-hmm. what's the piece of advice you would give yourself?
That's a good question. I don't know. Maybe just keep writing all the time, because I feel like, you know, right. It took me a sec. I mean, not really. It didn't take me that long, but I graduated college before I wrote my first screenplay. And it felt like there was this daunting task to write a feature screenplay. Like obviously I wrote shorts and stuff, but once you crack that, once you've written your first feature, it just becomes so much easier to write features. Like it's just, then you've done it. Just same thing with like shooting your first movie. It's like, once you've done it, you're like, I've been through the experience. I see it from the other side. Now I know what it takes. I wish maybe I had just written features earlier and, you know, like actually I have a better one. But this is like, you know, so hyper specific, but like when I was first trying to get my first movie going way back in the day, back in like 2003, that's when I first started trying to like shoot my first feature. There was this idea that like independent financing was less than, and that the goal was to work with mini major studios or work with a studio. And that's valuable. And if you work with independent financing, it's like, who cares? I think that's so stupid. And I probably would have been directing movies earlier if I didn't have that attitude up until when I directed my first feature. So maybe that's the answer.
Last question.
Yeah.
Is making movies hard?
Making movies can be the hardest, I would say. I would say with the exception of Horse Girl, like I mentioned, every movie I've made has been hard. This one was probably the hardest, and Huckabees was definitely the hardest also for various reasons. I've had one experience which emboldened me for this movie that was positive, which was Horse Girl, which was like literally from top to bottom could not have gone smoother. And when it got to sound editing, it got a little hectic and like sound design stuff, but like up for actual shooting it was great. And yeah, I mean, like having done 5 movies now, you feel like you're like, I got this. And literally that's like you don't. Like there's always going to be something that it's an art form that has hundreds of people coming together with a singular vision. And I mean, just look at what's going on in the world today. There's like no such thing as a singular vision. So to like keep everyone aligned and focused. And also, like I mentioned, there's no version where you're hiring all your people. There's always going to be some new people. And there is always the opportunity for those people to be, you know, not as great, maybe great people, or they might be toxic, even though they're really good at their job. There's like all kinds of stuff that could happen that is sort of out of your control and you have to roll with it, especially if you're in another country where you can't fire anyone because work visas take 3 weeks. So I would say for the most part, you will get blindsided by anything, even if you're the most prepared you think you are. Like you could be insanely prepared, just in like sort of like, what is it with like, is it Infinity War where like Doctor Strange like has 4 million permutations of reality? Or it's like even in Westworld where Jeffrey Wright like is like, I've figured this, like you could be doing that shit, but like it's still going to mess you up. There's still going to be things that you didn't expect because A, it's human nature to not be like completely, you know, infallible. And then it's also like just Murphy's Law in general with that many moving pieces and that many variables. So I would say movie making is really hard, but it's worth it because I love it. And it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, that's what I want to be doing, but it's certainly not easy.
Well, that is our time, but that was just fabulous. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
Liz, what do you remember about our talk with Jeff?
I remember him being a really good storyteller. I remember just wanting to hear about what it's like to work with the people he's worked with. I remember, you know, thinking that he had like a lot of celebrity friends and that he was able to call in a lot of favors to make things happen. And after you sit with him for a few minutes, you're like, oh, I get it. Like, he's just like a nice, hardworking, talented guy from what I can tell. Like, I think that is an attractive force that would draw people to him. Yeah, I was impressed. What did you remember?
Well, I did not know we were going to talk about Robert Zemeckis. And so like that whole thing and that experience of like that being like his first Hollywood thing is like interning for Robert Zemeckis was really funny. And I thought it was funny that he was like, oh, yeah, everyone calls him Bob.
Bob.
You know, but I didn't call him Bob because, you know, it's always just, you know, whatever. And it just reminded me of when I worked with Francis Ford Coppola and we all called him Francis. And it was just like the thing that we did because like he was that kind of down to earth person who would like say hello to you and like, you know, even learn your name. You know, a crew member of 100, one of 100, he like knew a lot of our names. You know, it's just like, oh, well, he was just Francis to everybody. I watched a Super Bowl with him, you know, 1 year. It's like, you know, so it's easy to like just fall into thinking that's normal. But then, of course, when you're outside of that experience, it's like, oh, well, you should call him Francis Ford Coppola, because if you don't, you sound like a dingbat. You know, so I was like, oh, well, even this guy who's married to a movie star feels that way. I was like, oh, okay, that's like a normal human feeling then, you know. So I thought that was interesting. I thought like his whole way of working was interesting and how he just like bounced from movie to movie. He's like, oh yeah, when I was wrapping up Little Hours, I came up with this idea for this thing. And then I made Horse Girl. And then I was like, wow, imagine that world where you just make movie to movie to movie to movie. It's like, wow, amazing. Incredible. That's what I thought to myself talking to him. But I guess when you partner and like also, he didn't really talk about it really, but it seemed like very strategic that he like would partner with a movie star as a creator, right? So he's like writing movies with Alison Brie. So it's basically like he's like got a built-in star for his movies. So it's like the funding just kind of rolls off the tip of your tongue when you're working with them as a collaborator, you know? So it kind of made me think like, that's pretty smart.
I can't believe when I did research before talking to Jeff that I didn't see this. And then you said he was married to a famous superstar. And I was like, what?
Oh, you didn't know that?
I didn't know he was married to Aubrey Plaza.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's how he got his first movie made, I think. Well, and I know that because insider baseball. So I went to an interview at American Zoetrope with this producer as like an informational interview because I worked with them. So like I was able to get connected with like one of their lead producers who produced Life After Beth. And it was the movie that he had just produced most recently at the time. And so I was like asking all these questions about Life After Beth. I was like, how did that movie get made? Like, how did it happen? Whatever. I want to know. Tell me so I can replicate it. And he was like, yeah, well, he's married to Aubrey Plaza. So, you know, maybe you should find a girlfriend who's famous. I was like, okay. And then he was like, yeah. And then he wrote I Heart Huckabees with David O. Russell. So it's like, that was like his way. I was like, okay, well, whatever. Just throw my hands up. Like, this is useless information. Like, I cannot, like, you're giving me stuff that I cannot replicate. Like, I can't be friends with David O. Russell and write I Heart Huckabees. And I can't be married to Aubrey Plaza or another movie star because I already have a wife. So
this is. Damn it, Beth. But I also, okay, so I didn't know that going in, right? But thinking back on it, looking at it through revisionist eyes, like, it didn't ever seem like he was relying on that. Like, yeah, sure, oh, it's a benefit. No. Of course it's a benefit. No. But he has this, like, confidence to him and his vision that I think comes across very clearly.
Well, I think like, to be honest, it's like him getting in the game right off the bat, right? And like working with such a famous person. Yeah. I think that's probably the key, right? The fact that he was working with Robert Zemeckis as his first job and then immediately met David O. Russell, was working with David O. Russell. So he's just in this sphere of like celebrity movie stars, Hollywood machine. Like he's already in it right from the beginning. And then to be like a credited writer on a humongous studio movie, it's like, well, of course your career is going to take off, right? Right. You know, so I don't think it was like purely nepotism or whatever you want to call it. That like is like his. I'm not trying to say that.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
What the producer was telling me was that that's the reason. But that was probably just him blowing me off and like wanting to end the meeting. So I'd stop asking questions, you know, and then funny side story about that producer. Well, I'm not going to do that. That's not fair. I'm not going to just air this guy's laundry. But I guess he's out of the business now because I went to ask him more questions. He's like, oh, yeah, I retired from Hollywood filmmaking. I was like, oh, interesting. I guess it's not necessarily a long career always for people. But anyway, so it was a very fun conversation. And Jeff, yeah, what an amazing guy. Really, really hard worker. And just shows that, like, if you put in the time and the effort and you stay focused, like, you can really do anything, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But Liz, this is it. It's the game. And I have the question for you this week.
Wait, are you not going to do the voice?
The game.
Thank you. It's like the highlight of the whole thing for me, really.
And people, let us know if you like this, because
Eric's taking it off the table. He wants to take
Eric
it off the table.
Eric is saying it's boring. He's like, no, it's not very good. I was like, what? We have so much fun playing this game. All right. Here is the question for you, Liz.
Okay.
You are a week out from production on a sweeping Western about a stranger that comes to town and fights for the rights of the simple townsfolk against the sinister railroad tycoon looking to take over. Love it already. You have just gotten word that there are no available horses in the area for at least the next 6 weeks, well after you're done with production. The upshot is that you have a considerable amount of more money now that you don't have to rent, feed, and maintain the horses. However, this means that you will not be able to shoot the stranger come to town on their horse, riding off into the sunset, or have horse-backed shootouts of any kind. Here's some extra notes. You do have access to other animals like cows, mules, donkeys, etc. With the new money, you have access to a great art department. Your climax is written to be a chase scene with your main character riding their horse and leaping onto a train where they would fight the railroad tycoon and their gang. What do you do, director? What do you do? This is a hard one. I like this one.
It's so funny. And I will out myself as a frequent viewer of Yellowstone. So this is an appropriate question for me. I watch Yellowstone with Sean every single day, and I love it. It is so soapy and indulgent.
Nice.
Beth Dutton is my favorite. Anyway, so she's Kelly Riley. Okay, so you don't have horses. Well, like, I think you lean on other Western tropes. Like, I get that the riding of the horse is very important to the Western. So no, I don't want to take that away from the Western. But if you can't have a horse, I wouldn't fake it. Like, I wouldn't get a fake horse and put them on a saddle and then, like, cut away from ever seeing them moving with the horse. Like, that seems dangerous. And it seems like a little cheap. I could be wrong. And we're going to get, like, angry emails of someone saying, I did that and it was beautiful. You can have someone walk off into the sunset, right? Or they could be a part of some other movement that doesn't involve a horse that goes into a sunset if you really need that. I guess what I'm saying is I would just take the whole film off horses. I wouldn't, like, replace it with a donkey or a mule or a cow or something else. And I would just turn it into not having them travel on these horses and make story exceptions or reasonings for why they're not fighting on horses. I don't love the use of horses in films, if I'm gonna be honest. I think, like, that horse didn't ask to be in that movie. So I'm okay with the horses being gone. I just don't know the major story issues that are now conflicted because you're taking the horse out. That's all. So I would just remove them.
Just had to figure another way for him to get on the train, which there are probably lots of ways you can get on a train without a horse.
Right? Yeah.
Could be a carriage. It could be all kinds of things. You know, there's all sorts of other...
But the carriage are horse strong.
You don't necessarily have to see the horses. Like, you can see them in a wide shot.
That's
like,
right.
Visual effects.
That's right. That's the only time I would pretend there's a horse, is if we lean on a carriage. I agree.
Yeah.
But I just don't want to do that thing where they're on a horse, but not really on a horse thing.
Well, here's my simple take.
Yeah.
A mule looks a lot like a horse from a distance. And
you want to replace it, the horse. You want the mule.
I would very minimal, because I would do this anyways. Like, I don't want to fucking shoot with the horses all the time. Like, that's not a pain in the ass. Like, I've done enough shoots with horses, probably like two in my life. And I basically know they're very unpredictable. Even when you're told by the trainer that they're going to do exactly what you think they're going to do, they don't do that thing. And if the person who's an actor does not know how to ride a horse, it is so hard for that to make that look convincing. So I'm already in the boat of, like, cutting down on horses, even if we had it all, horses and all the money in the world, unless you had, like, some legendary cowboy person who, like, knows how to deal with horses very well. And even if they say they do, don't believe that either, because I had someone tell me that, oh yeah, I've been riding since I was 10, and then, like, you know, like, cannot even get on the horse. So yeah, I would just
people
be very
will say
suspect.
Anything to get in a movie.
They will tell you all kinds of shit. It's ridiculous. For my answer, I would basically put them on the mule. I would basically have three shots. I'd have the riding into the hound town on the horse slash mule, visual effects it, and then same for running out of town. And then I would probably, in your scenario, come up with a different way for them to get on the train that didn't involve a horse, like either the carriage situation or maybe like the train's like going through and they're like not going to stop at the stop sign or stop sign at the train station. Or something, and then the guy jumps from the train station onto the train and, like, you know, gets whatever. Like, there's so many ways you could do it that would be super exciting where you don't need to have the horse. And yeah, I don't know. But I mean, this is a tough one. I think you would definitely have to do a lot of rejigging.
A lot of rewriting would be necessary.
But the fact that you're going to have extra money to play with and you'll be able to get a better art department and stuff like that, I think it will help you come up with like all kinds of fun solutions to your problem, to your story problems, you know, if you can, you know, build some cool stuff like building a carriage, for instance, you know?
Right. But if your movie's not strong enough when you take horses out of it, then you've got a problem.
You got a bigger problem than horses.
Yeah.
Your movie won't work without a horse, for sure.
That's right. And on that note, you could always send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcastandmakingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Don't forget to check out jambox.io. Royalty-free music and SFX company with an emphasis on high-quality cinematic cues. Their composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay and Martin Scorsese. They even offer customized plans to fit your needs, which is great. We thank Jeff Baena for coming on the show, to Judy Merrick from Katrina Want PR for setting this up. Thanks to our fantastic editor, Jeff Freimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being just pretty cool. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week. We also talk about, fuck, I need to finish that. I'm going to do it again.